session number 9437, reel 10.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 10. When you opened up a hospital in these village caves, did you have a lot of trouble cleaning them, first of all? You know, making the conditions sterile?
Well, we did the best we could. We didn't do very much. The caves that we used for the operating theatre, if possible, had a sheet, white sheet hung down at the back to reflect light, and a white sheet over the ceiling to stop dust and so on falling actually on the operating area. And such furniture as there was would have been washed down. I don't suppose we had any disinfectant by then, but that would be the idea. I'm going to cough.
How about the number of patients you dealt with in these various hospitals?
Well, they varied a lot. I should think probably we might have had as many as 200 at one time, but often there would be far, far fewer. The cases were nearly all military cases with minor gunshot wounds. I know we had one batch of casualties in, and they suffered far worse from iodine burns than anything else, because zealous first aiders had slapped on masses of iodine, covered them immediately with dressings, regardless of what the wound was, and left them on, you see, and they'd all come up in blisters and burns from the iodine. Nevertheless, we used to get a lot of much more serious ones. Sometimes a tourniquet would have been put on because something was bleeding and it would be left on. Nobody had taken it off, you see, because their knowledge was so skimpy. And then you'd be left with a gangrenous limb. I can remember Doug had a great many fractured femurs, open fractures of femur that were septic and with lots and fragments of bone and so on. And as we didn't see them, anything from the minimum would be 3 days. Often it would be perhaps 10 days before we saw them. The condition was very, very difficult by then, and the patient would be extremely run down and probably septicemia and so on, and it was very, very difficult to deal with them. If they survived the initial cleaning up of the wound, the patient then had to be put into plaster, and this was very difficult without the correct apparatus. And they evolved a splendid system outside, of which there are some photos. They put up a triangle of poles with bars at the top, about and with a little seat for the patient's bottom on one of the poles, and a table would be put at the same level as this little thing for the patient's shoulders. So that meant that the middle of his back was unsupported, and the legs would be supported on bandages suspended from the top of this triangle of poles. And then they'd put on a plaster around his waist and hips and down the affected leg and a little bit down the other one. We used to do this all in the open air. The plaster was... we had to use local bandages, which were very heavy, and the plaster sometimes was very inferior to anything we use now, not quick drying at all. So it was very, very laborious, and the resulting plaster was incredibly heavy. But nevertheless, it probably... not only saved the legs of the people we put them on, but probably saved their lives too, because without them being in plaster, the chance of them getting a decent leg would have been very slim. Also, the chance of reinfection would have been far greater than when they were covered with plaster. So that was that was an achievement of improvisation, and where the mechanics and the anaesthetist and everyone were involved.
Yes, I think you've got a photograph of that.
Yes, there are photos.
You?
Yes,
which
yes.
The museum.
Yes, we did a number of those. Yes, but certainly Doug Clifford had a very sad time dealing with these chaps who were so frightfully run down. Their hemoglobin was so terribly low; they all needed blood transfusions. But the Chinese think giving blood is very, very detrimental. They will only give a very small amount. Also, Doug found that their hemoglobin anyway was so low that in England they wouldn't have been considered as people to give blood transfusions. And when members of our team gave a whole pint, the Chinese thought that was absolutely fantastic and sent us gifts of chickens and eggs and things to build up our strength again, which we tried to return, usually without success. but they were extremely impressed. And certainly some lives were saved by us giving blood.
How often was that necessary to give blood, do you think, for your
team?
I
should think probably the group gave perhaps 10 times in all. Not a tremendous amount, but certainly there would have been. They would have used blood much more frequently if it had been available.
And did you have the apparatus for doing?
Yes, well, that's very simple. Yes, that's very simple.
Mm. Would it have been the normal apparatus, or did you have to?
No, you can improvise with it. If you've provided you've got a needle to go into the vein and a sterile bottle to put the blood in, that's all that's really necessary. So it's not complicated.
These soldiers, you know, that you were treating,
yes.
You're saying it sometimes took them 3 days. Mm. Presumably they would be making their way towards you from the battle
yes.
zones, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
How, they obviously knew where to come. Or?
Yes, well, I suppose the stretcher bearers were sent. Were organised and at where there was a battle, and then there would be walking cases as well, and I suppose they'd have some sort of a leader and they would be told where to bring people. But as I've explained, the terrain is all up and down with no roads, consequently they'd have to be brought over these paths, and they'd be quite slow with the stretchers. So
it seems to indicate that you must have been, you know, 3 days isn't that far. You must have been quite near the Gumingong
yes.
at times.
Yes, sometimes we were within 10, 15 miles of where there was fighting. So the poor authorities got rather jumpy about it with things. Mm.
You explained earlier how they were worried about you, you know, and your safety if you got into Gumingong hands. Were you at all worried yourselves?
Well, I personally never felt worried. It was extraordinary, really. I suppose because I was pregnant, I had some kind of magic protection from feeling concerned. I think perhaps the others were sometimes a bit worried.
The other thing I was going to ask you, you were talking about the gangrenous limbs. Did you make artificial limbs at all for people?
Yes, latterly, when we settled down properly, Frank Miles and Peter Early mainly, I think, decided they'd have a go at making an artificial limb, and they got some cowhide to make the top part that would go around the stump and some wood, and they made a really quite successful leg. The difficulty is that a newly formed stump is always a bit tender, and they did have some problems in getting the chap to use it, and we did make some others, but we weren't there long enough to know how satisfactory they were. But certainly It paved the way for better things to come. And actually, Dr. Peter Early, was the artificial limb specialist in Manchester.
That followed his experience in China.
Yes,
did it?
I don't know quite what went in between, but he certainly latterly was in the equivalent of Roehampton in Manchester.
Would seem there was a very high degree of improvisation in that situation.
There had to be, because none of the things that you normally wanted, like petrol to run the generator to use the X-ray machine, was available.
So you weren't able to use the X-ray machine?
No, very occasionally. I know one of the German-trained doctor fell off a horse and fractured his wrist, and they managed to find enough to run the generator to X-ray his wrist. But on the whole, that petrol was not available. It was only for very special occasions we could use it.
But you continued to cart it around with you, did you?
Not always. Sometimes it had to be left behind because it was so heavy and so difficult to move. But at least it didn't have to be totally abandoned.
When you had 200 patients, you know, you have explained how the number went up this far. Did you have any problems feeding them?
I think there must have been problems, and they must have had to collect food from over a wide area. Possibly the authorities had some food stores we were able to call on. And, of course, quite a number of the more able patients were employed in the kitchen preparing meals, which would consist of millet and perhaps marrow or squash or something of that type with it. And meat was fairly rare. I know one time I did feel sick during the afternoon and later discovered we'd been eating donkey, which had been killed by a wolf down when feeding at the river. So, you know, one didn't like to look too closely into the food. Though I must say, we were always fed very well, better than the patients and the nurses, which upset us rather, but there wasn't much we could do if we said. They said, oh, well, you're used to eating this food. We can't give you... We must give you more. The hospital also owned some livestock. They had chickens and also a herd of pigs. Well, when we had to move, now pigs must not be hurried or they die of heat stroke. So when we knew we'd got to move, they'd have to start off hours before us and be driven very, very slowly over the mountains, squawking and squealing. Otherwise, they'd have dropped dead from heat stroke and exhaustion. So this herd of pigs was very much guarded and shepherded very carefully over the difficult paths.
And you would catch up with that, I suppose?
Yes, we'd catch up with it. Sometimes they'd go a different route, but we'd catch up with them for the night or perhaps 2 days later or something.
What did you all look like, I wonder, when you were on the move? You know, this sort of column. Did you keep together or was it a straggling column?
It was fairly straggling, but we did try and keep more or less together because I think I mentioned earlier one time we got lost. So if you didn't keep fairly close, it was quite easy to take the wrong road because there wouldn't be any signposts.
Did you have sort of set positions within the column?
I don't seem to remember that, but certainly I think all the hospital staff kept fairly well together.
And would you have had soldiers sort of guarding you?
I don't ever remember there being real soldiers, but I think there were a few rifles carried by the hospital staff, but this was mainly for wolves rather than the enemy, because wolves are quite a problem up there.
Did you see any yourself?
Yes, I think I did see one or two in the winter. And there were horrible stories about wolves coming and attacking children. Children would be sent to the fields to watch the watermelons in the summer when they were ripening. I suppose animals used to take them, or neighbours pinching the fruit, and or other people. And there were stories of wolves coming in and attacking the children watching the fields. Actually, I do remember a child bitten by a wolf being brought into the hospital, so he must have been... They can't have been that frightened. When there was real trouble, they would come to the foreign doctors.
Were there any other pests you had to worry about, apart from wolves?
Well, bed bugs and lice, but the bed bugs were a real menace.
And what could you do about that?
Not much, actually. I'd slept under a double mosquito net with my husband, and he wouldn't be bitten at all, and I'd be bitten all over. So there's something to this business of them liking some people and not the others. The bedbugs used to live between the wooden edge to the kong and the base of it, you see. And if I used to wear a skirt in the summer, and if I sat on the edge of the kong with my legs over this wood, I'd get bitten all the way along the back of my knees. And, there were lice, and sometimes we did get lice, although we washed as carefully as we could. And Doug Clifford caught typhus, of course.
Was that very serious?
Yes, it was. He was very ill indeed, yes. That was, in a way, we were waiting for him to recover before we made our move to leave, because Eric and I had gone to China for 2 years, and it was getting on for 3 years. It was 2.5 years before we even suggested we might go home. Mm-hmm.
Did you have the right sort of medication for dealing with typhus?
Well, what he really needed was good nursing, and Dr. Li Bing looked after him very well. And he did make a good recovery, but he needed quite a long convalescence.
How did your supply of drugs hold up, though, during this, over the year period?
Well, we did have a small amount of penicillin, which we kept for ourselves, which I'm afraid I had to take some off because I had a septic finger when I was about 4 months pregnant, which wasn't too pleasant, and it wouldn't clear up with the ordinary treatment of lancing and so on. And so I did have to have some penicillin then. Other medical supplies were very short. We had some sulfonamide. Well, the hospital had some sulfonamides, but they had to be used with great discretion. We used to put sulfonamide powder in the wounds, but that came to an end quite quickly. Everything was in short supply to the end, and some of the antiseptics and so on were very harsh. I know... Doug Clifford had to be very careful because his hands were getting very sore from using this antiseptic before surgery.
Was it ever very frustrating, the fact that you knew what could cure a particular ailment, but you didn't have the stuff? Were you ever in that situation?
Yes, in any kind of primitive situation, you get that sort of situation. And actually, medicine was advancing at such enormous speeds then that even in the West there would have been cases that you couldn't have treated before the war, and after the war there would have been new drugs and so on. Nevertheless, a lot of corners had to be cut, a lot of improvisation had to be done, dressings had to be used more than once, washed and dried, which is something you would never consider doing now because of cross-infection and so on. And quite apart from the time-consuming and that sort of thing. And, you know, the plaster was inferior, the bandages were inferior, very heavy. There were a lot of things that were very difficult. The anaesthetics, of course, were not what we would have used if everything had been available. There were no oxygen, no cyanide gases in cylinders at all.
You were saying earlier how you were under the control of the communist authorities.
Yes.
Who was actually in charge of the hospital?
Actually, Mr. Lee, who was actually a political chap, was hospital manager. He was a very sensible, shrewd person who treated us very well indeed and with great thoughtfulness and kindness. He didn't speak English, but he always made special arrangements for us, and also, I don't know whether this was really necessary, but he was always pointing out to the hospital staff that we had lived in places where there was a bus to take us where we wanted to go at the door and that type of thing, and we'd come to help them and were prepared to walk with them through all adversity and so on. I felt he really rather overdid it, but it was wonderful that he did stand up for us so much. And actually, when we finally left the far isolated parts of China and got nearer and nearer to Tientsin and the coast, we were treated with less and less respect, and I can remember having quite a problem getting hot water to wash the baby and so on, because they said, oh, you foreigners, you know, you don't deserve anything, you can take your turn with the rest. And it was quite a nasty shock to find that I was no longer the honoured guest, and our poor interpreter really was most upset. He kept trying to explain to people that we'd really come to help them, which I really didn't feel I could quite live up to.
Could I ask you now about your teaching function while you were on the move with the hospital? You know, did much occur? Did you have
teaching
sessions?
No. Well, I
didn't
do very much, but I think Margaret Stanley was able to do more on the wards. She spoke quite good Chinese, and she worked all the time, while, of course, I worked less and less as my pregnancy progressed. And as I said, the theatres were more or less running themselves latterly. My services there were not so essential. But Margaret got to know the nurses very well and was able to pass on a lot of useful knowledge to them.
I remember looking at your photographs that there were several of little groups of people with someone lecturing to them in the various villages. You know, would lectures have been held? Would there have been sort of school classes?
Well, there were political indoctrination classes, and some of the things you refer to, I think, were back in Yunnan when the university was still running there. Then there would be wall maps with descriptions of the military situation and so on that would be painted up on the walls for everyone's consumption, not only the hospital people.
So it would have been mainly sort of political, do you think?
Yes,
and
yes. In day-to-day work, people would pass on to the people who were with them knowledge as you would in an ordinary class in a hospital in England.
Yes.
Yes. When the hospital was more settled at one time, we were in an area that had been under the rule of a warlord. Consequently, there were a lot of graves of people who had nothing to do with the local people and nothing to do with the communists. And with the help of Dr. Li Bing, they found a grave where somebody had died from illness rather than from gunshot wounds, and they raided it and took out all the skeleton. And Eric and I, with the help of a Grey's Anatomy, fixed it together to make a skeleton for teaching purposes. The first one we got out, we found the chap actually had got some bones missing anyway, and so they had to get another skeleton out. And because they'd been in the earth a long time and we didn't quite know what they had died of, all these bones were boiled in a cauldron, in a great kong, before we handled them. And eventually we were able to put an almost complete skeleton together. It wasn't easy, especially the wrist bones and that type of thing, but the main bones were all there, and it would have given the nurses and doctors a much better idea of what bone the skeleton looks like than they would from imagining it under the flesh.
So that would have been used for teaching purposes.
Yes,
then,
yes. I think the senior nurses must have passed on information to the nurses, perhaps in formal classes. I'm not quite sure.
What how would you rate the performance of the MT19 team in China? You know, the contribution you made to this International Peace Hospital.
I really cannot say that the contribution was very great because of the circumstances. We came from the West and we were so used to having so much more that probably the Chinese could do more with the available material than we could. If we'd been able to form a proper teaching unit in a stable surroundings, I think we could have made quite a good contribution. As it was, we did make a contribution because we made a certain number of Chinese people realise that all people from the West were not unsympathetic. But it was not as great a contribution as we would have hoped.
But did you find it difficult, you know, coming from a totally different hospital environment, fitting in with a more primitive system? Did you have to sort of compromise some of your standards and even your moral standards, if you like, to this
situation? Well, we certainly had to compromise on the medical standards because things were just not available. Nevertheless, there are basic principles that below which you need not go. And we certainly... Our knowledge was a good deal greater than that of most of the Chinese with us. And you can compromise from a higher standard better than you can without having the knowledge to work on. You can judge what things can be overlooked and what things are essential. And I suppose, possibly without knowing it, we were able to pass on a great deal more than we can visualise. And also, of course, we were foreigners working with the Chinese as equals, nearly as equals, which must have made an impression on some of them because so many of the foreigners had been a group apart and considered themselves superior to the Chinese and more important and different. And that was something we did try to overcome.
I'd like to ask you now about your pregnancy and... We'll get on to your confinement too, I hope. You were saying how in the beginning you were rather embarrassed about this.
Yes, well, I didn't let anyone know for about 4 months. And then after I'd had this of course, our own group knew. But I didn't let the Chinese know because I felt so... really, having really done it on purpose and the conditions changing so that it was really just the last thing that ought to have happened was rather a shame. But anyway, somebody spotted that I was getting a bit fat, and so it all came out. And after that, they treated me with velvet gloves, as it were. And I still used to go to the operating theatre sometimes, particularly if Doug had a big operation. And I preferred it that way. And fortunately, I was extremely well, had no problems. I had this septic finger, but I got over that all right.
That must have been worrying because...
It was a tiny bit worrying because I kept thinking of Dr. Bethune.
Did he die of that?
He did, yes. But then, of course, we had this penicillin. But, of course, it was the old-fashioned sort and I had to have injections every 3 hours. So we had an alarm clock and Eric used to stick it in my bottom every 3 hours all through the day. But that did do the trick. And after that, I was very well. But as I say, I had to be carried on a stretcher when we moved at one time. I don't know whether it was because of that we crossed the Yellow River, where we were safer from any enemy attack. But anyway, we were able to do quite a lot of good work when we settled at this place, Shobatai, I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Were you at all anxious, though? I mean, when you set off from Yunnan and you were pregnant, did you have any idea that you were going to have a baby while you were on the march, as it were?
Well, I must admit, we had thought when we first left Yunnan that we would settle down a few miles outside Yunnan and work perhaps for 3 or 4 months and then come back to Yunnan. But when things didn't work out like that, I still didn't feel worried. I don't know. It was wonderful. I felt, well, I've got a nurse and doctor actually here with me. And somehow I just didn't feel anything would go wrong, even when I knew he was going to be a breach. I wasn't worried. It was marvellous. I hope nobody else was worrying.
How about your diet, you know, while you were
pregnant? Yes. Now, that was again where the authorities showed such marvellous care for me, because I think I mentioned Ernest Enks and his cows. Well, they brought a cow that was in milk to our village and saw that I had a pint of milk every day from this cow, which was really most thoughtful and kind. And apart from that, well, the very simple diet we had probably was the best thing I could have had.
How about your clothing? I mean, these baggy padded trousers.
Oh, well, they were
stretch.
Absolutely splendid, yes. Yes, of course, the baby was born in November. I suppose the trousers must have been pretty huge, yes. Anyway, there was no problem there. And it was nice having these padded trousers. I think I said it was like taking your own upholstery round with us, because through all that time, we never had any chairs, but we had a trunk, an American footlocker, as they're called, and I used to sit on that or lie on the kong on my sleeping bag. And so for all that 9 months, I never sat in a chair. I only sat on a trunk. So
when you were carried, you were saying how you went on a stretcher for a while. Was there any particular reason for that? You know, had you not been well, or?
Well, it just was that you know, if we were going to walk 20 miles, I couldn't be expected to walk 20 miles. But I used to get up and walk part of the time, but they didn't expect me to walk more than a few miles every day.
So you didn't really have complications?
None. No, not a thing. No, it was marvellous. Mm.
So when the time for your confinement came, were you actually settled in this village?
Yes, yes. I think they'd probably taken us there knowing that that's where I'd have the baby. We'd got there in... we'd got there in August the 21st, and we stayed there right until March the 22nd the next year.
This is August the 21st... 1946, is it?
This is 1947.
1947, yes, of course. And so what date was your baby born?
He was born on the 15th of November. I can't remember now whether... I think he was late, according to our reckoning. I can't remember now. But anyway, he was... everything went smoothly. It was a fairly long labour, and Doug apologised that he couldn't give me any sedation because... only very mild, because he hadn't got the drugs to revive the baby later if it affected the baby. So, but anyway, I didn't have any difficulties. Margaret Stanley gave me chloroform, which to an English person seems absolutely terrible, but apparently at that time it was quite normal in America. That's another example, you see, of how the things are so different. But anyway, everything went all right. It was Doug I was sorry for, because I don't know how many breech deliveries he'd done. And anyway, it was a splendid baby.
Did he have to operate on you?
Well, I did have an episiotomy, but then that's fairly common, so that was all right. It only meant a few stitches afterwards.
And were you uncomfortable? You know, was it a worrying experience, knowing that it was breech and you couldn't have...
Well, that's an extraordinary thing. I didn't worry. It was wonderful. Yes, yes.
So you wouldn't...